Thank you for tuning in to the Best of Movie Geeks United, a collection of some of our most memorable interviews from the past 7 years. Tonight, we welcome three fascinating directors, starting with Stephen Frears, who directed the Oscar-winning film The Queen and The Grifters, followed by James Wan, who's responsible for some of the highest-grossing horror films of the past decade, including Saw, The Conjuring, and Insidious. And finally, legendary filmmaker William Friedkin, the man behind the classics The Exorcist and The French Connection. Let us get to our first interview with Mr. Stephen Frears. Tomorrow Drew, his new film, is currently in limited release. I'm sure it'll open wider as the weeks go on. It's a great story. It's funny, it's charming, it's very sexy. It's kind of about this at one time ugly duckling, Tamara Drew, who returns to her hometown in the countryside as a very, very powerfully sexy adult woman and throws everyone in a tiff, and she kind of turns the lives of people in this village upside down. It's very charming. It's based on a very popular comic strip in England by Posy Simmons, who really was crucial to the project. She worked closely with Mr. Frears on it. And it has a very different kind of visual style for Mr. Frears because he's following a graphic novel. He almost has a storyboard to work from as he shot this movie. So we talked to Mr. Frears about all of that. The interview is conducted by our correspondent, Aeronautic Diaz. Here is Stephen Frears.
How are you settling in?
It's paradise.
Did it sell?
Well, of course, my kind of books aren't about sales, so no.
His touch was like a cosmic yes.
Nadia, go to the pub and stay there. I'll come when I can.
Who are you talking to, did it sell?
Marriage. Remind me never to try it.
You're just a sex object. No one would have you.
Sometimes I wish I could get distracted.
Hello.
Who's that? That's Tamara Drew. Good God, what's happened to her?
She's had a nose job, Dad. I love your new hooter. Not actually you, it's just smaller.
She's single, you know.
What do you have to do to get a cup of tea around here?
Make it. Tea, sugar, fruit.
She's completely different.
I couldn't agree more.
He never grew up.
In his trousers.
Is your house?
Yeah.
Want to buy it? No. I want something else.
Oi!
What does she see in that little boy?
Maybe she's trying to make you jealous. Or maybe she's just a bit kinky.
Do I get my treat?
You are so cheesy.
The real secret of being a writer is learning how to lie.
Even if I was the last man in the world, Tamara Drew wouldn't have me.
When can we do this again? To the muse. However you find her.
I didn't know they provided material too.
But you once said that British filmmakers that aren't interested in making and telling stories about their middle class.
Yes.
As your movie does.
Yeah.
Why do you think that is?
Well, I don't know. We all tend to be middle class, and I suppose perhaps we find that perhaps we don't like our own class, or we're embarrassed by it, or perhaps we find the working classes and the upper classes more exotic. Mm-hmm. I'm very aware of it. I mean, it's very noticeable. The French make films about the middle classes. Perhaps the actors feel uncomfortable.
And this is based on a very popular comic strip.
Yeah.
How did you get involved with that? How did you become aware of this property?
I was sent the script.
Okay.
But before that, I'd read the comic.
Mm-hmm.
On when it was on in the newspapers, and indeed I've known the graphic artist for 40 years.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
And are you a filmmaker or? Do you distinguish between you know, when you saw this, you know, in the papers and you saw this,
thought it would make a film until I read a script. Mm-hmm. I just thought, what a brilliant idea, but it wasn't my idea.
And have you gotten any indication of her feelings on the finished product?
Posey, she seems very pleased with it.
Adaptation of comic strips / graphic novels are kind of the in vogue thing right now.
Yes.
Have you followed?
I've only read one graphic novel in my life.
Okay.
Which is this one. But I've begun to learn about this whole world. Mm-hmm. And when I go home, I'll try read some.
Film, you know, obviously film is a visual medium. Graphic novels are a visual medium.
Yeah.
You know, it seemed that they seem to, while they're not the same visual
medium. I've come to see that what Posey Simmons does is exactly what I do.
What was your challenge? What was the biggest challenge with this script as a director?
Oh, you know, to keep the spirit up.
Mm-hmm.
To keep people, you know, keep people's spirits up. Not to let it get, you know. Mm-hmm. Always with comedy, you need it to be like a souffle, to keep the souffle up and in the air.
Well, how about, I'm curious about this. With the, you know, the tone of this story is very delicate. From dramatic to kind of light, whimsy, and ricocheting back and forth.
Yeah.
And so that tone is very important, you know, to the success of the story. And so I'm curious, as a filmmaker, when you're in the process of shooting, when do you become aware in the middle of filming that it's clicking, or is it not until the editing room that it starts to come together?
No, you don't leave the floor unless it's right, really. I mean, you go on shooting a scene until you've got it right.
Mm-hmm.
I guess in the cutting room you discover if your judgment was correct. But I could always tell when the scenes were where what I thought they should be.
Was there a rehearsal process on that?
No, not really. I think the people are very, very well cast,
mm-hmm.
which means there's not a great deal to rehearse.
Are you not a big proponent of the rehearsal?
No, I prefer it to be more sort of spontaneous. I like it to come from the actors, and I like to be able to see what they're doing.
But on the same hand, you're not a 2-3 takes and out kind of filmmaker. Is that correct?
I would be if I was braver. I can hear when something is right.
Right.
I really direct with my ear as much as my eye.
And one of your collaborators in this is the great composer Alexandre Desplat.
He's wonderful.
You know, Benjamin Button and many other scores.
Yeah.
And what was that collaboration like?
He's a brilliant man.
Mm-hmm.
And he reads films in a very, very clever way. It's a joy to know him.
What has been your most surprising and most, I guess, maybe rewarding of this kind of screening the finished film for people?
Well, so far it's been very, very gratifying. You just see the pleasure it gives people. You know, when I grew up, films were both enjoyable and intelligent. And there wasn't this sort of separation that takes place.
Right.
So I suppose what I'm trying to do is to make a film that is like, you know, the films that I grew up with.
Right.
You know, when you went to see a Billy Wilder film, you didn't say, this isn't done commercially. It was just generally extremely enjoyable and clearly made by men of high intelligence.
One of the directors you worked under early on was Lindsay Anderson.
Yeah.
And what did you gain from working with, you know, those early giants of the British 60s cinema?
Well, you learn a lot about life, really.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were highly intelligent. You know, you learned how to think, really, and how to live. I think more than anything else, they're sort of inspiring in their lives.
You work primarily a lot of times in your home country and telling stories about the middle class. But every now and then, you do turn your eye to American-based stories.
Yeah.
The Grifters and Hero in particular. And you've done this a few times. I'm curious on what is it about, I guess, you know, America, as kind of generic as that may sound, that
I've grown up seeing American films, reading American books.
Yes.
It would be a miracle if I wasn't interested in American things.
Right.
I mean, I can see that whenever I've made a film here, I've used a sort of different bit of my brain.
And when you made like a movie, when you do a grifter or a hero, are you at all aware or consciously aware that, you know, particularly in the, you know, like in the grifters, that you're working in kind of the, you know, American film noir tradition? And
I remember I always used to, in the cutting room, I used to say, is this an American film or a European film? Of course, the American film noir tradition largely came from Europeans.
And the same thing with Hero, that was obviously in the Frank Capra screwball tradition.
Yes, that's right.
And was it fun kind of working in that kind of, working within
yes.
the mechanics of that kind of storytelling?
Yes, and I could see that the films were largely influenced by the American cinema. Yes, absolutely.
Your last big hit here from 3 years ago is the Queen.
Yes.
Was spectacular, and Helen Mirren got an Oscar.
Yeah.
And so I'm curious about, you know, because that film is very smart, and obviously because of you and screenwriter Peter Morgan, about the British, present-day British monarch system.
Yeah.
Kind of it's clashing with
yes.
kind of 21st century media culture.
Yeah, yeah.
And I'm curious of what you, if, you know, what you think of, if anything, if there have been any new developments in that kind of clash in the last, since you've made that film.
You know, it was the only time in my life that the Queen was really criticized.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that first of all, that's a sort of tribute to her, I suppose. I mean, I don't think, I don't think there'll be a revolution in my lifetime.
Are you wary of that, or are you kind of hoping that never happens?
Well, most of my life has been spent wanting change, but I don't think there will be any change. You know, it's quite odd being a subject and not a citizen.
Okay. What are you working on now?
I may make a film in Las Vegas in the spring.
Oh, really?
Hmm.
Wow.
About a sports foot gambler.
Have you been to Vegas before?
I was there 3 weeks ago.
And what do you think of that obviously very kind of American city?
Well, normally, the only times I've been before, I've gone as a sort of tourist.
Right.
And this time, I had a sort of inside pass because I was with people who live there and work there. And it was, I mean, I found it very, very interesting.
Before I let you go, I got to ask about one of my all-time favorite films of the 80s.
Yeah.
That's Prick Up Your Ears.
Yep.
And I'm just curious, any kind of, you know, it's almost coming up on 25 years of that film.
Good God, yes, you're absolutely right.
And, you know, now, you know, everyone kind of takes Gary Oldman and Alfred Molina as a given. Everyone now knows them. And I'm convinced there's still a ton of people who don't even know this film.
Yes.
And I hopefully if they hear this, they'll go out and rent it.
Yeah.
I'm curious, what do you remember most, looking back at that film, what do you remember most of that experience of working with those two actors, you know, before
they were both very, very good.
Yeah.
Gary looked like Joe Orton. Fred looked less like Halliwell. But,
right.
But they were both wonderful. And I'm not surprised that both of them, I mean, they were really good. You know, I was just lucky. I was the person who took them into a film. But they were going to be successful. They were very highly regarded as young actors.
That story of those two guys and their kind of doomed relationship really has, still kind of has a potency and resonance.
Yes, I
imagine. Probably even more now than maybe some of them thought of then, would you?
Yeah, well, I remember the real relationship. I remember the you know, the killing and the bodies being found.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it resonates now.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the world has got much better.
Who's that? That's Tomorrow Drew.
No, it isn't.
I met her with Andy.
God, what's happened to her?
She had a nose job, Dad.
She's completely different. That's what Andy said.
Poor Tamara. She's such a sad girl. She's come to help you wash the car, didn't you, Nicholas?
Yeah, I was with his teenager.
She liked a bit of family after her dad left. Is that Tamara Dream that went to Colony on the Sundays? She used to. Much the independent now.
Oh, yeah. She spent weeks going on about her nose job. Was her old one an awful conk?
Yes.
Herself into those shorts. They don't give her thrush.
We begin tonight with writer-director James Wan. James is the writer-director of the first Saw film in 2004 and has executive produced the remaining films in the series leading up to Saw 3D, which opens Friday, October 29th. Had a new Saw film every year for the past 7 years. How and this is the final installment. So, is it bittersweet for you?
Yeah, no, it definitely is. It's we never set out to make something that was going to last as long as it did, and it ended up becoming like this really big thing that ran away from us, and now we're going to finally be putting it to bed. I think that's not a bad thing.
So, made it feel like the right time to do that?
To be honest, really, I think just because I'm pumping one of these movies out every single year, it's really exhausting. Because the moment the film comes out, right, we would have to get ready like the script and have to make it, get into production and do it and get it ready by the next year. It's really taxing on the producers and the entire team. So I think people are tired and people feel like I think the audience have we get the impression the audience wants to move on from it, and that's fine, And so we wanted to wrap it up, and we felt like this is the final one to wrap it up with.
Yeah, yeah.
That's really the short of the long answer is we are exhausted from it, and it's been a great ride, and it's time to call it quits.
Yeah. Sure. I'm curious. I want to talk about the origins of Saw with you as soon as he calls in. But as the series has progressed, and you've served as executive producer on many of the later installments, has there ever been a moment where satisfying the needs of the fans has kind of butted heads with what fulfills you creatively, where you think the series should go creatively?
Well, it has been a very tricky process, just because unlike a lot of other horror films out there, the Saw films actually have a very intricate plot line, I think it's like the only horror film out there that that can never be accused of not having like any kind of story behind it. It has story, it has plot points. If anything, I think to a fault that sometimes it's too much, and it's kind of hard to keep track of it. So I think one of the hardest thing is really just like keeping track of where timeline, where things fall, what has been done, what hasn't been done, what other story strands there are to explore, and when you're up to number 7, you've pretty much explored everything, and I think that's another reason too why we think we've pretty much explored all the story there is to tell, and I think I think this is the perfect time to kind of stop now because there isn't really anything else to tell, at least at this moment. We think we've got to the end, and we want to click quits for now. I think the producers, the actual producers, and the guys on the ground, doing the real tough groundwork and all that, have done a great job, keeping the fans satisfied, but at the same time trying to find something new and fresh to say. And that's definitely kudos to the producers and kudos to the other two writers that came on board once Lee and myself were no longer as hands-on with it as we were. Lee wrote up to number 3. My involvement pretty much became less with 2 and it became less with 3. And that's only because, I have my own movies to go and direct. So it's kind of hard.
Yeah.
It's kind of hard to, still be in the mix when directing a movie basically takes up an entire year of your life, really.
Right.
And so it's been a tricky one. You know, it's definitely very bittersweet for me to kind of, sometimes just have to kind of let it go and let other people take care of it.
Right.
To some degree.
What has your involvement been these past few years in the series? I mean, they obviously, do they consult you about the directions that they want to take?
Well, they definitely do to some degree. And it's gotten to the point where, kind of like what Carpenter ended up doing, which was, he just kind of gave his blessing, as a Pope would do, just kind of like, it's got to the point where I feel like the producers are so much more, so much more dialed into the world than I am at this point. So my main thing, and it was always my main thing with the sequels, was just to make sure that it did not become too ridiculously silly. That was the thing, and just the very nature of making sequels, especially sequels to horror film, is they tend to break into those boundaries, break the boundaries and into territories where it becomes really outrageous. Fortunately for the Saw film, it's very outrageous to begin with, so it's not like if they got really crazy, it's not too far from what we had established in the first film. Now, having said that, I've always said the Saw sequels are definitely so much more, out there and so much more removed than the first movie that Lee and I made, and I think in a lot of ways, when people talk about the negativity of the Saw films, I like to put it down in some ways, they kind of lump the first film in it, and they talk about the first film in this sort of retroactive way, where I like to remind people to go back and see the first one, that the first one really was it's a pretty, by today's standards, a pretty low-key psychological thriller, there was very little traps, there was very little blood and guts, and a lot of that happened off-camera anyway. You didn't see a lot of this blood and guts stuff, and it really wasn't until the sequels that it kind of earned the reputation of being the grandfather of, I hate using this term, but the torture porn genre.
Yeah.
I hate that term because I never set out to make a movie like that, and I don't think my first film was like that. But it ended up falling into that bracket.
It absolutely was not your original film. I mean, your original film is a very tightly wound, claustrophobic thriller.
Right. It was a thriller.
Yeah.
Yeah, it wasn't a blood and guts horror film, so to speak. It was an outright thriller. In the same way, remember how, there was a period there before now the resurgence of respect for Texas Chainsaw Massacre, Toby Hooper's version, right? But there was a period there in the late 80s or in the 80s where people were just so against it, saying, oh, how bad that film was and how, corruptive it was and how bloody and gory. And it wasn't until, recently, in the late 90s or recently, right, that people look back at it and go, you know what? The first Texas Chainsaw that Toby Hooper directed is a masterpiece. It's a horror masterpiece, of suspense and tension and scare. And it only had one or two little sort of gory set pieces that really stood out in people's mind. But the rest of the movie wasn't like that at all.
That's actually my all-time favorite horror film, original Chainsaw, and it's masterful in a way that Saw is masterful, in that in a lot of ways it deceives you into believing you're seeing a lot more than you're being shown. I mean, Hitchcock, that was Hitchcock's playbook.
Yeah,
the most graphic
exactly.
thing about Chainsaw Massacre is the title, the Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Yeah, exactly. You're right. The title was what put it into the video nasty category.
Yes,
the title
yes.
really made a lot of people believe that it was a much more nastier film than it actually is. And I guess kudos to those guys for actually coming up with such a sensationalistic title that got a lot of people talking, when you're making these low-budget indie films, you kind of need to stand out. And back then, that was their way of standing out. And for us with the first Saw was, finding, kind of cool way to basically tell a story that people are pretty familiar with, which was, you know, a serial killer storyline, but try and find a fresh perspective to tell, you know, a story that we're all familiar with, but tell it in a different way.
Yeah, and but you see this with all sequels. I mean,
yeah.
across genres, the more kind of sequels you make, you don't get more minimal in your approach. You raise the stakes. You up the ante.
Yes.
You up the murder quotient.
Exactly.
Or the action quotient. Yeah.
Right.
So I think
right.
it's
no,
just
you're,
a product
you're totally,
of that.
You're totally right. I mean, especially sequels to action films. Look how huge the action movies get with every sequel, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
look at
the Transformer films. You know, like they just get bigger and bigger with each one. You know, look at Die Hard. That's also another good example as well. How like each sequel. You know, like the first Die Hard was a freaking masterpiece, you know?
Mm-hmm,
and the second one is really cool, too, but the second one is bigger than the first one, and then the third one is bigger than the, you know, than the previous one, and the fourth one is bigger than the previous one, so, you know, and then you have your Star Wars sequels.
Yeah, exactly. It applies across the board. If Lee calls in, I'll pick up his line right away, but you must be a fan of the thriller horror genre. I mean, that must be of particular influence to you in your young life as you were planning to become a filmmaker, wasn't it?
Yeah, I am. It's funny that you mention Hitchcock because I'm a big Hitchcock fan. You know, just like in the way Hitchcock inspired people like Steven Spielberg. So therefore, I'm a huge fan of Spielberg. You know, obviously Spielberg is the generation of filmmakers that I grew up with. You know, from Indiana Jones to E.T.
Mm-hmm.
to Jaws. I just think, you know, like I think of all the directors out there to take on the Spielberg to take on the Hitchcock mantle, it was Steven Spielberg who did it best, I think. And Jaws to me is one of the finest thrillers ever made. You know, horror
yes.
thrillers ever made. And so yes, I'm a big fan of like suspense, tension thrillers. And of course, you know, like I love the Italian Hitchcock, Dario Argento. You know, who obviously brings his sort of quirky sort of European quality to that sort of Hollywood style of thriller storytelling, and you know, and bring a very sort of visual quality to it. And so I'm a big fan of Argento and Mario Bava, and when Lee and I first set out to make our first, you know, small little indie movie, we wanted to infuse the film with a lot of these inspirations and movies that we love. But having said that, we wanted to do it our own way. And so,
yeah.
So therefore, you know, we created our own villain. We created our own sort of, you know, sort of iconic take on things, you know, like how do we hide the identity of the killer? Well, we hide the identity of the killer by having the killer speak through a puppet sitting on a tricycle. You know, which always seems really funny when I pitch it like that. But you know, for some reason, you know, it was just one of those things. You know, it was in the zeitgeist, and people just really caught on to it. They love that, and it's so funny that Billy the puppet became the face of the franchise.
Yes, yes. When we spoke with Brian De Palma, who's you know, an exceptional director of thrillers,
right.
they asked him, why do you work in that genre? And he said, well, because it's the most cinematic of the genres.
That's true.
Yeah,
I totally agree.
Visual, yeah.
Yes, I totally agree. And for directors that love to manipulate an audience, it is the best. It's the best genre, the horror thriller
mm-hmm.
genre, because you know, like you can literally, you know, you can make an audience laugh and scream and you know, just like go through all kinds of emotion. You know that that you don't really find with a lot of the other genre. I mean, you know, you can make a comedy, but usually I can tell you a lot of comedies don't scare you in the middle of the film, you know what I mean? Whereas,
yeah.
Whereas horror movies, horror films would scare the hell out of you, but then they'll kind of like lighten that mood a bit with something that makes you kind of like laugh to relieve that tension, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
And you don't find that in a lot of dramas or any other genre. But you do with the horror thriller genre because for a director, it's the most fun to play with because, you know, you compose your shots, you write your script in such a way, you craft, you know, everything is the perfect genre for a director who loves crafting the medium of filmmaking, you know, from visuals to sound designs to the way you interact, you block a scene, to the way you move the camera, to the way you cut a sequence and the way it plays out, and the way, you know, like you get your actors to emote in the scene and stuff like that. So it's definitely one of my favorite genres to play in for that reason.
Yeah, it's a director's toy box, I would think, that genre. Tell me about you and Lee went to school together.
Yeah, Lee and I met in college, yes.
Okay, and this collaboration is obviously a very successful one. It's continued up till now. You guys have Insidious coming out, and we've actually spoke to Patrick Wilson a little bit about Insidious, and we're very excited about it. What clicked between the two of you? Why does that collaboration work so well?
It's so weird, you know, like, I haven't really worked in Hollywood for that long, but in the short amount of time that I've been here, you know, I have worked with a lot of different writers, and I've collaborated with a lot of different artists, and it's funny that Lee Whannell is definitely still one of the people, if not the top person, that I get along the best with when it comes to do with like ideas and concept and things that we have in common. When it comes to do with movies, we are so in sync. You know, we love the same things, we hate the same things, and what I really admire about Lee as a writer and as a concept guy as well is he never wants to settle for second best. He's always like trying to push me to come up with the best concept, best ideas, and I really admire that about him. And I find that when he does that, it really brings out the best in me as a director. And his writing is really strong. And, you know, he's a really great writer, Lee. And even though we generally, most of our movies, we don't have a lot of money to work with, but at the end of the day, we realize it's okay to not necessarily have, like, you know, the big summer tentpole kind of budget to work with, as long as we get to tell our stories and we get to tell, like, smart, you know, stories that people haven't really seen before. Lee and I really pride ourselves on coming up with things that are unique. And there's really only, like, what, 10, 12 stories out there that you basically just recycle again and again. I don't know which, you know, great storyteller actually said that, right? And all you do is really repackaging it. And even then, I find Hollywood is kind of lazy sometimes. They don't really make the effort to try and find new ways to tell the story. And that's why, you know, like, I would read all these scripts, and to me, they're so boring. All these scripts, they all read the same. They all have the same sort of, they're so predictable. And yet the films that get made, are these films that Hollywood's kind of afraid to take chances on films that are unique because, you know, they go, well, we don't know if those films will be successful because it's not tried and true. It's not proven. It's not a formula. And I admire that about Whannell. So I think that's why he and I have mutual respect, and that I come up with all kinds of crazy concepts, and I throw it at Lee, and I go, hey Lee, what about a movie about this or a movie about that? And if he likes them, that's when I know I've come up with something really cool.
Yeah.
You know, just because he holds such a high standard to what is good.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and you guys have ridden this roller coaster together. I mean this tremendous success of Saw. I mean, you guys got into it together, and you guys have risen to the top together. And I'm curious. You had
it's
no
so
idea.
Funny that you see that, Jamie, because I still see myself as an underdog. I still see myself in many ways. Making it in the horror genre doesn't mean you're at the top of the game. I mean, you know, like, maybe if you make it in the action or sci-fi or drama world, then you're at the top. Then you become like, you know, like your Chris Nolan or your James Cameron type, right? But making it to the top of the horror genre, just because of the way people kind of look down on this particular genre, I'm like, you know what? For me, it still feels like I'm still at the bottom, and I'm climbing my way, you know, trying to make my way to the top. And I like that. I like being the underdog, despite the fact that that Lee and I have basically, you know, the biggest horror franchise out there.
I know exactly what you're talking about, because there's an element to horror that is kind of disreputable.
Right, exactly.
And actually, some of the best horror movies I mean, I think the horror genre almost works because of that. I mean, the best horror movies are underground. You know, they're done in that manner.
Don't you find it ironic that a lot of the movies that deals with social ill or make the loudest social commentaries are horror films.
Yes, yes.
You know, I mean, Mike, I look at Texas Chainsaw and I look at movies like, you know, like Texas Chainsaw was such a commentary on the Vietnam War. I mean, my goodness, you know, and then you have Night of the Living Dead that was a commentary on the period that it came up with. And it's really interesting to hear people say that Source was the post-millennium type of, the first real post-millennium horror film. And it is somewhat of a reflection of the era and time that we now live in, you know, in the 2000, you know, like that is post 9/11, that is post terrorism, and it's a really different world that we live in. And I find the horror genre more than any other genre in particular that really ties itself to the era the film was made in, and I don't mean it dates itself. I just mean it's a big sort of social commentary about the era that it was made in. If that makes sense.
I think so too, and it works as a classic thriller, so it's timeless in that respect. But when you look at it, as you say, through the prism of 9/11, how far are we willing to go to survive?
Right.
You know.
Right.
Yeah. What are we willing to compromise here? Now, did that come into play as you were writing it? Was that just a byproduct of what you had ended up writing, or how did that?
You know, I think I wouldn't say we were consciously out there trying to make some kind of social statement, right? I would say that, but I definitely do believe in a big way, you know, like it did creep into our subconscious. I mean, it's hard for it not to be, do you know what I mean? Especially when we wrote this story in the, I think we came up with it like in the early 2000s, you know, the overall concept, or maybe even the late 90s, like just the seed of it, right, the concept we come with, but we sort of didn't really sort of like form it till like, till Lee started writing the screenplay.
Well, horror movies are just ideally suited to make social commentary,
and the thing is, you can make those social commentaries and get away with it that you may not be able to do so in other genres. Maybe the only other genre is comedy, where you can make fun of someone and get away with it because that's funny, you know.
And you don't have to hit people over the head with it, unless your villain actually hits someone over the head.
Exactly.
Yeah. What do you think the legacy of the series will be or is?
You know what's really incredible is I would get fan mails and I would get, you know, so like Facebook or MySpace messages from people, right? From especially like young adults and teenagers that loves this franchise, and the one thing that seems to be very common is how they would point out how they love that the movie deals with a villain who basically asks you to kind of take a look at your life and appreciate what you have and not take it for granted what you have, right? You know, like, in a very 80s and 90s world where we kind of take everything for granted and it was very celebrity, cultural-driven, right?
Mm-hmm.
It's really interesting to hear today's kids actually say to me that they really latch onto that idea, the concept of not taking what you have for granted and kind of like be thankful of what you have. So that has been a big part of the legacy that we never actually thought that people would latch onto. You know.
Yeah.
you know, but they've definitely latched onto the subtext of the film, which is incredible. I mean, you know, obviously, the stuff that people, that the fans love on the surface is, of course, you know, like the cool, fun traps, you know, the twisted mystery, you know, and the twist ending, and you know, the sort of messed up nature of it all, which, you know, at the end of the day, you know, Saw really doesn't try to pretend to be anything other than, you know, it's a roller coaster ride, but in amongst all this stuff, you know, when Lee wrote the first script, he tries to make it more than just a throwaway horror film, you know, like any good writers would want to do, you know. So
like any great movie, it entertains as you're watching it, and it lingers when you leave it, you know. I mean, it gives you something more to chew on,
to think about.
Yeah, it's about morality. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I think the other big legacy that we cannot ignore, as well, is the fact that you know, Saw 3D, which is Saw number 7, right? It's about to come out. It comes out this weekend. What that legacy has done by having a new Saw movie come out every year is it's become such a big part of such a big part of, like, these kids growing up. It's a big part of their life. Do you know what I mean? Because, like, every Halloween, they've got a Saw film to look forward to. They know that there's a Saw movie coming. And that's why it's kind of sad, I guess, in the respect that, you know, I get a lot of Facebook messages from these fans saying that they find it sad in a nostalgic kind of way that, you know, the film is coming to an end, because it's a big part of growing up for them, you know.
Yes.
Every year during Halloween, they've got that to look forward to, and now it's finishing. So I think that's the other legacy as well, you know, that there's a generation of kids years from now when they grow up, you know, like, you know, when they're in their late 20s or 30s or whatever, they will look back and they have such memory, whether it's fond memories or not, they have such memories of their teenage years growing up, right, off the Saw films.
Yes, I mean it can play as integral a part in their adolescence as, you know, Jaws played for you when you were a kid.
Exactly, and the way Jaws scarred me for life about not wanting to jump into the ocean. Yeah.
Yes.
But the funniest thing is, I would hear people go, "Oh, you know what? I got my first kiss while on a date to watch one of the Saw films." I would hear that a lot.
Wow.
To which my reply would be, "You're welcome."
Well, I really appreciate your time, and I'm so sorry about the technical problems.
No worries.
Before I let you go, Insidious, your next film, is there a release date set up for that film?
No, not yet. You know, like, you know, even though we did kind of get a version of the movie ready for the festival, which we did get it ready for Toronto. We premiered the film at the Toronto International Film Festival, which it was, you know, really well received. And I just got back recently from Spain because it played at Sitges. So even though, you know, I got a version done, but I had to really rush, like any movies that are not quite finished yet, but they want to get it ready and get it into a festival, is you kind of like rush to try and get things done. So I'm actually still tweaking and still putting the finishing touches to it. You know, I like to think it's going to come out sometime next year, because there's really only, what, 2 months left in this year, so it's definitely not coming out this year. And Lee and I are so excited about this film, because we feel like we've finally made a movie that we think is, you know, after Saw, we went and made Dead Silence, and though Dead Silence is a fun movie, we felt like we didn't get the setup to make the scary film that we wanted. And I think in a lot of way, Insidious is that film. You know, it's, when you watch Insidious, you can tell our love for the genre. We wear our love for the genre on our sleeves with this film, but at the same time, we did what we did with Saw, which is we find a fresh perspective to what is essentially is a pretty stale, you know, sub-genre, which is the haunted house genre. I mean, my God, the haunted house movies have been done to death. And so, once again, you know, Lee and I like to think, you know, we found a fresh angle to it, and I think the fans really responded to it at Toronto.
Let's get right to it. William Friedkin exists in the pantheon of our most interesting and influential filmmakers. This Academy Award-winning director has made a number of films that can rightfully be heralded as true masterworks. The French Connection, The Exorcist, and To Live and Die in L.A. chief among them. But the totality of his work, from Sorcerer to Cruising to Rampage to Bug, complete the portrait of an artist who is unafraid to tackle challenging and oftentimes incendiary topics with a claustrophobic and bruising style and an open-eyed approach to dramatizing the ambiguities and contradictions of the human psyche. These qualities certainly define his latest film, Killer Joe, which tells the story of a young man who hires a hitman to dispatch of his mother for the reward of her life insurance policy. This NC-17 film stars Matthew McConaughey, Emile Hirsch, and Gina Gershon, and opens in select theaters starting July 27th. Over the course of the 68-minute conversation, Mr. Friedkin and I discussed the qualities that generally characterize his work, how The Exorcist might be different if he were to make it today, the ongoing legal battles that plague his epic 1977 film Sorcerer, and his views on the current state of cinema.
So you guys are united, huh? United to do what? Take over the world? Or?
United to celebrate cinema. That's what we're all about.
Well, that's a very noble ideal, and I appreciate it. You don't need saving now, Jamie.
Well, that's part of what I want to talk to you about film as it is today, because when I think of you and your work and the work of so many other directors that I greatly admire, they seem to be to play a key role in the film culture of the time. We really seem to have a film culture then. Do you sense any of that remaining today?
Well, it's different. You know, the zeitgeist was different in the 70s. It was starting to change in the 60s when I started to make films. But by the 70s, it had definitely changed. And then it went through, a number of transformations to where it is today, which is largely a vehicle. I'm talking about cinema, is largely a vehicle for comic books and video games and old television shows and stuff. And you know, even the European films, which so influenced my generation, are certainly, I don't see too many masterpieces coming out of Europe today either.
Mm.
So, but this happens. I mean, the culture was quite different and not all that bad when I started making films. And many of my colleagues and I, you know, we couldn't wait for the next film by the French New Wave or the Italian neorealists or Kurosawa and some of the other Japanese directors. And now I find myself really not in sync with what is popular in this country.
I feel the same way, and I've spoken to many people about this, including, years ago I had a conversation with Paul Schrader, and he was talking about how he believes that cinema, going to the movies, is going to be relegated to, you know, being a theme park experience.
But that's the new generation. I have to tell you, I honestly don't bemoan it. It just is the way it is. And I think the entire culture has gone that way, not just films. You know, the kind of paintings that are appreciated today and this kind of music, popular music, there's been a vast deterioration to anyone that's ever experienced anything else. But, you know, for example, you can't expect people to continue painting like Rembrandt or Vermeer, or let's say to turning out popular music like Cole Porter and the Gershwins.
Mm-hmm.
There's going to be a vast sea change for every generation in all the arts. And there is one now in cinema, without a doubt. Now, only time will tell whether this is just sour grapes or whether it in fact represents a deterioration of the culture.
Well, that's kind of what worries me, because I think of the films you did, pick a filmmaker from that period of time when you were coming up, Altman, Scorsese, you know, just pick one. And a lot of their works were, even if they were subversive, they dealt with kind of social commentary. And I think that the movies of today might reflect an apathy that is troubling to me.
There is an apathy. You know, you have to look at the late 60s and the Vietnam protests. And, you know, I was in Chicago in 68, you know, the convention,
mm-hmm.
Where Humphrey had been nominated to become the Democratic nominee. And the kids, you know, mostly led by young people, were all in the park protesting the war. And for a few years before that. Now I think we're in wars every bit as stupid, if not more so, than Vietnam was. It's been a continuation of stupid mm-hmm. wars that have ground up our young people, you know, while these old dudes sit up there in Washington and eat $300 martini lunches and screw up the economy. But there's nobody in the streets, mm-hmm. and the people that are in the streets seem to me to be more or less just hellraisers, you know, not people with a legitimate sense of protest. So that's changed. Yes, there is an apathy. In the 60s, what was going on today, the attack on Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, all of that would be wildly protested. And now, I don't know, maybe it's the drug culture that kicked in. Most of the people are apathetic. Where are you, by the way? What part of the country are you in?
I'm actually in Florida at the moment.
Okay, well, here in California, the legislature has so messed up the mm-hmm. state's economy that public education, as we know it now, is doomed. You know, there's no money in this state. And yet a lot of taxes were collected, but they went to graft, corruption, cronyism. They didn't go to the schools or to fix the roads or to make the state safer. I don't know where they went, where this money went. And there is a vast layer of corruption over most of the states and the country itself, and very few people speaking out against it. In fact, the journalists of this state and this country seem to be narcotized. And, you know, I don't know if cinema can do anything about that. I think it's just headed on a different path, which I find to be very sad, very sad. Look at the generation of young people that have been ruined by participating in these horrible wars that have gotten us nowhere.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the last war that meant anything was World War II. And, you know, it was a just and righteous war, and I think the outcome was good. After that, we've squandered the human and natural and financial resources of this country. But I don't see that in the movies anywhere. I see a mm-hmm. celebration of all that.
Well, and of course there were troubled times in past decades, including the greatest decades for film, because the artists reflected and kind of commented on the times that we're living in. And I see the world of today, and I think, well, it's more important than ever for artists to feel that connection to the world and express it.
Yeah, but you don't see it in cinema.
No.
You know, you had a different kind of, to just stay with film, you had different kinds of filmmakers who were motivated largely by literature and their own life experiences. And today they're motivated by old television shows, video games, and comic books.
Right.
And I, look, I enjoyed comic books when I was a kid, but that wasn't the steady diet of movies that we had.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think about the artists, the great artists that inspired you, and it's something that always strikes me as curious about where people draw their inspirations. I mean, you were inspired by, I'm sure, Wells, Hitchcock, the French New Wave, all of those giants. But was there a moment when you felt that you transcended those inspirations and found your own unique voice?
No. I mean, the thing that keeps me going, the reason I keep making films is because, one of the major reasons, because I know that the audience that I once had is not out there anymore. But what keeps me going is I haven't made a film anywhere near as good as Citizen Kane or, let's say, for example, Psycho or many others. And, you know, I still cling to the delusion that as long as I am able to keep at it, maybe one day, you know. But no, I mean, there are four people that really changed cinema. First was Griffith. Griffith set the whole style and tone for the kind of cinema that was then made in America and attempted throughout the world. And then that was basically in the silent era. The next person who changed cinema was Orson Welles with Citizen Kane. He synthesized everything that had gone before, and he pointed the way to where film could go. And then it was Jean-Luc Godard with Breathless, which is still echoing throughout the zeitgeist. More television, as well as films, are made closer to Breathless than anything else. The jump cuts, the kind of loosey-goosey style, anything goes. It was kind of like modern art changed to painting. And then finally, I think the last real change was 1977, Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
And the Star Wars reverberation continues today. You know, that's the most influential film, I would say, of my time. And that's where it is today. Possibly something will come along, who knows when, and change it again with the new media that's come on, you know.
Did you feel when Star Wars did come out in 77, I mean, you were coming off of The Exorcist and The French Connection, and you were tackling Sorcerer, I believe. Did you feel that sea change at that time? I mean, was it evident?
Soon after. You know, not immediately. It was a film that really captured the enthusiasm of people of all ages, and that it would have a wider impact. No, I didn't feel that. But soon after, you could see that was the direction that all the major studios wanted to head in, and that's where they are now. They're just still doing Star Wars, only with better technology.
I wanted to ask you a question about, and I guess it relates to cinema today, about the type of material that you are attracted to. Do you find it more difficult to find something that really turns you on enough to invest your time and talent in?
Jamie, you know, I think I've only made 15 or 16 films.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, at least 45 years of doing it. And it's not for lack of trying. There are very few things that really interest me. You know, I've directed a lot of operas over the last 14 years now. I've directed about 14 operas and all over the world. And that's a fascinating new challenge for me. But, no, I don't see a lot of things, nor do I get a lot of ideas that I think I could get financed. You know, it's not simply what a filmmaker would like to do. It's who's going to finance it. It was put best by a dear old friend of mine who's now passed away, Sammy Kahn, the lyricist. Have you ever heard mm-hmm. of him?
Yes, sir.
You know, Sammy Kahn was one of the great lyricists. He wrote Come Fly With Me. He wrote, 50 or more hits, many of them for Frank Sinatra. And he was often asked, what comes first, the music or the lyrics? And his answer was always the phone call. And that's really where it's at. You know, the phone call standing in for the financier, some guy who wanted a song written. That's how it used to work. A publishing company or a particular artist would want a love song or an up-tempo song or whatever, and Sammy and his writing partners would come up with the song.
Mm.
And they became classics. They became standards. Today, you know, that phone call doesn't come around too often. There are only a handful of people, I think, and I can't even name them, who could make exactly what they want to make. I mean, you take even the great American filmmakers of today. They have to make films whose primary aim is to make money. Now, there's nothing wrong with that. You know, film is a commercial medium. Popular Hollywood film. It's a commercial medium. No one ever called it show art. You know, it's show business. And so even the great filmmakers who are around have got to try and do something that a lot of people want to see, or they're not going to be able to make films. And frankly, there's not a lot of things that I think would work that interest me for today's audience.
But even so, I mean, it's obvious that in Tracy Letts, in his work, you've found someone simpatico with you. What is it about his particular voice that you identify with so much?
Well, he and I guess, share the same worldview, you know? We are fascinated by these characters who live sort of desperate lives with their backs against the wall. They contain equal parts of good and evil. They embody equal parts of good and evil. There are no heroes. I could cite many more examples of how we see the world, not with rose-colored glasses. Mm-hmm. He also happens to be, you know, a really first-rate dramatist. Not just my opinion. You know, he's won the Pulitzer Prize and for drama and the Tony Award. He has a terrific, unique, contemporary voice. He was out here in Hollywood for, I think, 6 years or so. I didn't know him then, but he couldn't get a job. He couldn't get a script assignment, and he tried to be an actor. He's now a very successful actor. You know, he's going to star in Who's Afraid of Virginia Woolf on Broadway this fall. And he was out here for 6-7 years trying to work as an actor, a writer. He couldn't even get a meeting. He couldn't get on the Love Boat. And so he went back to Chicago, which has become the most important theatrical city in America in terms of originating the new drama. And he's flourished there. I directed one of his plays, too, here in Orange County at the South Coast Rep. I directed his play, The Man from Nebraska. So I've done three of his pieces, two on film. And he hasn't done that many more. I don't know how many. I think he's only written 5 or 6 plays. But I've liked the other two as well. But it's not like I'm just looking to do to adapt plays by Tracy Letts. But I think he's a great writer today. He's as good as there is in this country.
My payment is $25,000 in cash, in advance. No exceptions.
25?
Yes, sir.
Oh, you said 20?
I was told 20.
25. Is that a problem?
We don't have a problem with 25. That's not our problem.
And what is your problem?
We have a problem with the advance.
No exceptions.
Sir, let me explain. One of the reasons we're interested in having this done is my mother holds a very large insurance policy.
They usually do.
Now, we thought if we could guarantee payment after the policy had been covered...
But this really isn't open for discussion. The conversation is finished.
This is...
What do you think this was, huh? Let's make a deal? This is serious business you're fucking with here, boy.
I'm aware of that.
No, I don't think you are. I don't take you seriously.
This is going to get done one way or another.
Our conversation is finished. I never met you. You never met me.
Well, when I think about your work, and Killer Joe definitely is included in this, I think of characteristics like they're surprising, they're a little bit dangerous, and there's a streak of ambiguity that runs across many of the themes and characters. Is that a fair assessment?
Yeah. Well, life is ambiguous, Jamie. You know, we don't know the ending. We certainly don't know the beginning. There are just great mysteries surrounding us. And one of the things that interested me the most around the time I made The Exorcist was the mystery of faith. You know, what it is and why and how deep are people's beliefs. And it still fascinates me. Mm-hmm. There are other mysteries. Of course, everything around us is a mystery. We have nothing to say about when or to whom or how we're born. Nothing to say about how we're going to leave this veil. But also love is a mystery. You know, why two people can meet and fall in love and somebody else can meet the same people and not even notice them.
Mm-hmm.
Birth is a mystery. There are all these great mysteries. Nothing seems to be resolved. And so... why should drama wrap everything up in a neat package when, you know, it's not a neat package? What fascinates me enormously, even as I get older, since and even before The Exorcist, was here was this man, this young Jewish man in his early 30s, walking around the diaspora, a very small part of the world in the Middle East, and he would preach in the street and on hillsides and in synagogues and to very small venues, and he died, I guess, at the age of 32 or 33 after having preached only 3 years that we're aware of, and he walked around in a robe and sandals, mostly in the desert, and begged his food. If anyone had told you then that, you know, the trillions of people would believe in this man as a deity, that they would have said you were crazy.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
trillions of people have this belief. That's what interests me the most, not only the story of Jesus, but Buddha and Muhammad, you know, and Moses. This mystery of faith. And then the opposite of that, Adolf Hitler, you know, really a homeless tramp who was unemployed, begging for money in the streets of Vienna, and was a guy you wouldn't look at twice. And then an entire race of the most intelligent people on earth followed this imbecile into hell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, those are the great mysteries that I still think about and read about and talk about.
Well, that ambiguity that you talk about, I love that in film as well. And not only for the reasons that you've just articulated, but, you know, the past couple of years... we've been studying on the show the films of Kubrick, and we've brought on about 60 of his collaborators, and the one thread that keeps coming up is the ambiguity of his work. And I find that what that does is you can watch a Kubrick movie at the age of 20, it can mean one thing, and then it kind of redefines itself when you watch
right.
it years later, because you are different. You're bringing something different to it.
You're absolutely right. You know, I continue to watch Paths of Glory in 2001, Doctor Strangelove, and The Killing.
Mm-hmm.
Those are the four Kubrick films that that have resonated the most with me. But I thought his work was a revelation when we saw it. I think the first thing I saw was The Killing, and it's one of the great, you know, genre films. It's a B picture, but it transcends that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's hard to believe, but 2001 was heavily criticized, if not ridiculed in its day by the critics. But it influenced a whole generation of young people. I didn't list that as one of the films that changed cinema. But, you know, in many ways it did, but things didn't go that way. Things
mm-hmm.
didn't go toward the mysteries of life or the ambiguity. They went the opposite way.
Yeah.
But 2001 is the most ambiguous of all films. And the films that resonate with me are films like that, where at the end of the film, it's left with you. It's left with the audience to make of it what you will. In many ways, The Exorcist was that, too. I'm not talking about the quality of The Exorcist versus 2001, but I found that what people brought to that film, to The Exorcist, is what they took away from it. If you believe that the world was a dark and evil place, you know, where little children were mysteriously destroyed from within, that's what you took away from The Exorcist. If, on the other hand, you thought that there was a force for good constantly at war with the darker forces within us, and that sometimes they would triumph, not always, but sometimes, that's what you took away from the film. The same
mm-hmm.
with 2001. You know, what is that slab? You know, to many people, the obelisk has no meaning, or it's just confusing. To me, it's the most profound statement of the mystery of faith I've ever seen in a film.
Yeah.
And the mystery of a kind of a divine presence in our lives that we are not meant to understand. It's the most seriously agnostic film I've ever seen.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Agnosticism being, you know, a belief that the power of God and the soul are unknowable. Not that they don't exist, but that they are unknowable. And I think that, to me, is the ultimate message of 2001.
I think so, too. And I see it in The Exorcist as well. I mean, you always talk about The Exorcist as an exploration of the mystery of faith, as you just have. But I'm wondering, as you've lived your life since The Exorcist, and your faith and understanding of things has evolved, do you think if you were to make The Exorcist today that you would have made it in any way differently?
You couldn't make The Exorcist today the way I made it. It would have to be ludicrous, the way all of these Exorcist sequels and ripoffs have been.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you'd have to escalate all the special effects. It would all have to be so wildly supernatural and without any kind of realistic base to even get considered today.
Mm-hmm.
No, you could, even though the film, as you probably know, remains enormously popular and is continuing to be seen by, you know, vast hordes of people all over the world. One of the reasons for that is with Warner Brothers, we've kept it alive. You know, we've made versions of the film that look like the film was made yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And there's nothing dated about it. But the idea of the story itself, the way Blatty wrote it, and the way I interpreted it, no, you couldn't do that today. It would have to be, you know, complete bullshit,
mm-hmm.
which is what these films are. They are not made by people who are exploring the idea of a faith-based society. They're just made to rip people off and sell tickets. You couldn't make it today, no.
I don't think you could either, but what interests me is a director such as yourself, your relationship with your previous work, because I suppose one way to look at it would be you look at The Exorcist and you think, that's where I was at that point of my life. That's like a marker of who I was then. Do you feel that do you still feel that you completely relate to the William Friedkin that made The Exorcist at that time? Are you still in that same place?
Oh, sure. You know, I mean, that's an omega point, a story like The Exorcist.
Mm-hmm.
It's, you know, it isn't something that once you reach that point, you then back away or transcend it. No, my interests remain the same. I believe, because I know so much about the actual case on which this film is based, I know that something happened in that case that was either, how can I put this? It was either mass hallucination or something transcendent that occurred.
Mm-hmm.
There were, in the 20th century, there were only three cases known that the Catholic Church had authenticated as demonic possession in this country. Now, today, around the world, you have guys who claim to be exorcists or priests or whatever, and many of them do two or three exorcisms before breakfast, you know? And there's a guy in the Vatican who is the Vatican's official exorcist. His name is Father Gabriel Amorth, A-M-O-R-T-H. And he claims to have done thousands of exorcisms. And to me, he just gives exorcism a bad name. I think there were very few. I think in our time, I think to a great extent, obviously I wasn't around during the 1949 case, but possibly there are other solutions to the affliction of that young man then, who is 14 years old. He's still alive today with no memory of what happened to him. And, you know, the church through the Jesuit diocese in the Washington area still keeps an eye on him because he lives back in that area. And clearly, from my reading of the files of the case, which were given to me by Father Henley, who was the president of Georgetown, Father Robert Henley. One day he sat me down and let me read the files, which included the diaries of the doctors and the nurses as well as the priests who were involved in that case. And it was clear to me that something transcendent had occurred. And
mm-hmm.
I don't know whether you ever saw the Washington Post front page article about that case in 1949. Have you ever seen that?
I haven't, no.
You can Google it. It's out there. It's written by a reporter who was on the Washington Post called Bill Brinkley. It's a front page article that runs for almost, I think, over two full pages. And it describes this incident in 1949 in the Silver Spring, Maryland area, which Brinkley refers to as a case of demonic possession that was in fact cured by this lengthy exorcism as performed by the church. And it's very rare to see something like that given credibility on the front page of a major American newspaper. You know, that wasn't the Inquirer. Bill Brinkley later went on and became a very successful novelist. He wrote a comic novel called Don't Go Near the Water, which became a film. But all laid out in this newspaper, on the front page, the upper left-hand column is where it starts with a big headline, is a description of that case.
Wow.
And that and the diaries and other things that I've been privy to have have deepened my faith. But I don't have any ultimate conclusions because I'm not Catholic. I believe that the organized religion is basically pretty far from the teachings of Jesus.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I mentioned a guy who walked around in a robe and sandals, and now you see, you know, the fathers of the church wearing costumes and, you know, gold-plated silver, you know, they eat off fine china, and they drink great wine, and they own banks, and they own real estate, and it looks like a lot of dress-up, you know, and it's just not what I perceive as the teachings of Jesus. But, you know, God moves in mysterious ways, as they say.
Dr. Klein.
Yes, I'm Dr. Klein. This is Dr. Taylor.
Sharon, things have gotten worse since I phoned you. I think you've got to come upstairs.
Is she having spasms again?
Yeah, but they've gotten violent.
Did you give her the medication I gave you?
Yes.
What was that? Oh, well, that was Ritalin.
Chris, doctors.
To ask you about this particular film, because when I announced to our many of our listeners that we were going to welcome you on the show, the overwhelming majority of them wanted to know about Sorcerer, and I understand this is your most requested film.
It's a very strange thing that's happened to Sorcerer. As a matter of fact, I think the first point in the legal case that I brought against Paramount and Universal, the first response is today, and I'll know either today or tomorrow how this will be continued. But for many years, both Paramount and Universal allowed the film to be shown. It's still available on a very bad and an old VHS, which I didn't make. It's the only one of my films that went to DVD or Blu-ray that I had nothing to do with. They just sort of snuck it under the radar. But for many years, both studios that had financed it had made it available to film societies and universities and all over the world. As recently as last year, the American Cinematheque had a retrospective of my films, and, you know, it was a huge success here. And they ran Sorcerer. Paramount made a new print of Sorcerer last year. And then all of a sudden, these requests were denied by both studios. And they both claimed that they didn't know who owned the picture.
Mm.
They had no record of whether Paramount owned any rights or Universal. And none of these film societies could... or schools could get it anymore. By the way, this has happened to a number of other films, such as Blade Runner and White Dawn that Phil Kaufman had made, many others. And it appears, I mean, they wrote to us saying, we don't know who owns the film. We don't anymore. We can't say who does. Now, I understand that the film was put into a joint corporation that Paramount and Universal had formed a number of years ago, well, you know, over 30 years ago, they formed a company called CIC, Cinema International Corporation, that was set up for the purpose of jointly distributing Paramount and Universal's properties overseas. They were not licensed to do business in the United States, CIC, only, you know, Europe, Latin America, and elsewhere. And that company has long since folded. And so there's that development, and there's the fact that the studios want to erase all memory of 35-millimeter film. They want to convert to the new media as quickly as possible. That is, DVD, Blu-ray, or whatever is going to very soon follow it. And Eastman Kodak no longer makes 35-millimeter stock. So within 2 years, nothing will be shot on 35, and, you know, you'll only be able to see it in revival houses, and the prints will all be very bad because there's nobody around who cares about, you know, film preservation, really. And so I sued Paramount and Universal to determine the ownership of the rights. And their response is due today. We've asked them to produce every imaginable document pertaining to Sorcerer. And my personal belief is that they don't have them. That what they've done is what the studios have always done, is destroy their legacy. They don't really want you or people to see an old movie. They want you to see a new movie. They've stopped being cooperative with film societies, with rare exception. I mean, Warner Brothers will still make all of their stuff available to you know, legitimate film societies and universities. But Paramount and Universal have started a process to eliminate all of that. And Sorcerer fell between the cracks there. So I'm trying to determine ownership. And, you know, it may well be that I own the film, in which case I will make it available to anybody, you know, any legitimate organization that wants to run it. It's a very unique and original suit. But they are claiming they don't know who owns the rights. Now, there's a bunch of young lawyers at all the studios now who really have no memory of the studio's past, and what they largely do is after a certain time period, they destroy all the files. So they may not know who owns it. But they did as of last year when they had this enormously successful run of it at the Cinematheque. And I was there. I did a Q&A, and they had lines around the block to see it. There's a group here called Cine Family, a group of, you know, film lovers like yourself and others. They requested it, and that's how this came up. The studio sent them emails saying, we have no idea who owns this, and we don't. And that's what provoked my legal action against both studios. And all we're asking for, we're not asking for money from these studios, we're just asking for, you know, the right to keep the film in circulation to those who want to see it.
Well, yeah, you're trying to save your film. And I would imagine that the ultimate goal would it be a Blu-ray release so everyone can have access to it?
Yeah, absolutely. And I said in my lawsuit, this is not about money. If I receive any money as a result of obtaining the rights to Sorcerer, I will donate it to film restoration and preservation.
Mm-hmm.
Every dime.
Mm.
So I just want the film seen.
Suspense. Adventure. Mystery. Danger. Courage. Roy Scheider in a new film by William Friedkin, Sorcerer, rated PG, starts Friday at a theater near you.
Sorcerer was an incredibly ambitious film for you. And it's grown in stature as the years have gone by. But when it was first released and it didn't really perform as well as I'm sure you had hoped, how did you take to that? How did that affect you?
Jamie, let me try and explain this to you. When you say didn't perform as well as I hoped, I thought that I made the film as well as I could.
Mm-hmm.
Roy Scheider, who was the lead, and even the other cast, with the exception of a young Moroccan actor named Amadou, who was my first choice, none of them were my first choices. The script was written for Steve McQueen, and Steve McQueen loved it and wanted to do it, but he had just married Ally McGraw, and they were very close, and he wanted me to write a role in for Ally McGraw. And he had told me that it was the best script that he had read. And could I write a part in there for Ally? And I said, gee, Steve, you just told me it's the best script you ever read. There really is no major role for a woman. I'd have to change the whole thing.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, all right. He said, are you going to shoot it in this country? And I said, no, I found some fantastic locations where I want to shoot it. Very primitive and rugged locations. He said, well, you could find that here in the United States. He said, because I can't, I don't want to be away from alleys. I said, well, I'm not going to shoot it in the United States, except for one sequence. And and then he said, well, okay, make her the associate producer or something. And I was really arrogant at that time. Possibly only a little bit less so now. But I said, no, I don't believe in that credit, associate producer.
Mm-hmm.
I just don't believe in it, and I'm not going to do it. And I was an idiot. I didn't realize then what I've come to realize, that a close shot of Steve McQueen, is worth the most beautiful landscape you can photograph. And the same situation occurred today, I would do whatever I had to do to get McQueen into that film, because if I had McQueen, then Marcello Mastroianni would have signed on to one of the other parts, and Lino Ventura, who was a great French star, one of the best film actors ever. And they would not take second or third billing to Roy Scheider. Now, I think Roy was great in the film. I really do. But Roy was not a movie star, and I think the film needed that. On the other hand, I'm happy with the film, Jamie. I love the film. Despite the fact that it was a financial failure and that the critics mostly, dumped all over it, the film works for me. Now, I don't compare this in any way to, let's say, the work of some of the great artists in the past who got no recognition. But you take Vincent van Gogh, who had made well over 3,000 works of art in 10 years and never sold one.
Mm-hmm.
He never sold a painting, but he continued to paint. And now you can't buy a Van Gogh, for less than $10 or $20 million. And Van Gogh never made any money on his films, but he continued to paint. I have not ever thought about simply making films to make money. Now, I realize you're better off if your films do make money, in that they hopefully appeal to a wide audience, and they bring back the investment to the bankers. But I'm not a banker,
Mm-hmm.
I've really been blessed by the fact that I was able to make films. I never went to college. I never went to film school. I've never really had a lesson in film. And I've made about 15 or 16 films. Some of them I like. Some of them I don't. Some of them I think work. And when I say work, I mean for me. I can't put myself into the mind's eye of other people, Jamie.
Well,
there are people I know who who love and revere Sorcerer, and I'm very grateful for that. But if I hated it, it would mean nothing to me.
Well, I didn't mean to be at all dismissive when what I said. It
oh, you
weren't. Before,
no, it's a legitimate question, when I tried to answer it as honestly as I can.
No, I understand, but it actually mirrors what we discussed with 2001. I mean, as the years went on, people recognized I misunderstood that movie, and they looked back at it and they thought, well, this is a masterwork, and I feel that the same thing has happened to Sorcerer.
Well, 2001 is a masterpiece. People just didn't recognize it at the
exactly.
time.
Exactly.
As they didn't recognize Vermeer's View of Delft. Are you familiar with Vermeer and the View of Delft?
I'm sorry to say I'm not. No, sir.
Well, Johannes Vermeer is perhaps one of the greatest artists who ever lived. He lived in the 17th century in a little town called Delft in the Netherlands. As far as we know, he never left Delft. We don't know anything. There's no pictures of Vermeer, no portraits that we know of. There are only 35 surviving canvases by Vermeer, no sketches. We don't know if he ever studied or with whom. It took 2.5 centuries for Vermeer's work to be discovered, and I first saw these paintings, 21 of them, were gathered together at the National Gallery here for the first time in Washington. And I saw them, and it was a life-changing experience. Now, Vermeer died broke in his lifetime at the age of about 43. And he died broke and crazed. He had a wife and 13 children. Mm. And there was a custom in this little town of Delft, that when someone died, when any citizen of Delft died, the city fathers would come around and they'd collect his clothing and donate it to the poor. Vermeer's clothes were so ragged and in ruins that they simply burned them. And his wife had to give many of these paintings away to the baker and the grocer and others to pay their debts 1.5 years after he died. Today, of the 35 known Vermeers, the View of Delft, which is to me the greatest piece of landscape painting I've ever seen. It's a cityscape. Today, well, in 1995, when it was brought over to the United States for the first and only time to the National Gallery, it was insured for $100 million.
Wow, wow.
Now, go figure. Vermeer, as far as we know, seldom. He died because he couldn't sell any of his work. So I mention this to you not to put myself anywhere near the genius or the talent of some of the great artists who've ever lived, but simply to say that the value of a work is very often not apparent in its own time. And so, look, it's consolation enough to me to know that Van Gogh's entire output and Vermeer's small output were not recognized then but are now. Now, I don't know what will happen to the films I've made, you know, after I'm... I have no idea. They could be forgotten, like the work of a lot of filmmakers whose work I admired. It's hard to see anywhere a Richard Brooks film anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's very hard to see an Elia Kazan film. Very difficult to see a film by Carl Theodor Dreyer, mm-hmm. or even Antonioni. You know, things move very quickly, and they move on to the next case. And that's what happens if you are fortunate enough to be able to create something on this earth to ever have it be recognized in its time.
Right. One collaboration that fascinates me, and a film that fascinates me, it's really stayed with me, is Rampage. And your collaboration with Morricone on that film. What can you tell me about that?
Well, you know, I think Morricone and Bernard Herrmann were the two greatest composers of film music for me. And I just called him out of the blue after I'd filmed Rampage, and I sent him a work print copy, and he called me back. He spoke very little English, but he had an agent who spoke good English, and I went with him, and I met with him, and I really wanted a kind of a driving score from Morricone that would drive the film more, like the score he did for a film called Investigation of a Citizen Without of a Citizen. What was it called? Investigation of a Citizen Under Suspicion, something like that. It was a great movie. And I wanted a score like that. And he didn't see the film that way. He saw the film as a tragedy. And a tragedy not only involving the victims of this guy, who was known as the vampire killer in Northern California. He saw it as a tragedy of human nature. And I kept pushing Morricone to write some more driving rhythms, but he couldn't. He wrote I think one of his most moving and deep scores. And we weren't completely in agreement about it, but God knows, it was a thrill to be working with him. And every time I heard, you know, something that he had written, I have to be honest and tell you, I didn't think it worked. And I kept asking for a more energetic. It was called Investigation of a Citizen Above Suspicion. A police chief who was murdering women in order to be able to investigate and solve their murders. It's a great film by a director called Elio Petri. But I worked with Morricone at his apartment in Rome, and at the time he was concentrating on writing classical music, you know, for concerts, and doing fewer scores. But I must say, it's a time in my life that I have great memories of having worked with him on that.
And the other collaboration, and it concerns your new movie. You're working with one of the great cinematographers, in Caleb Deschanel, and I'm curious about not only your collaboration with him, but your relationship with your DP on your films in general.
They all differ, you know. I mean, basically, The French Connection was Owen Roisman's first film. He had done another film, I think that he shot in Puerto Rico or something, but I don't even know if it was ever released. But I met him before I did The French Connection, and he was like 31 years old and had really not done anything, but he did this one feature. I don't remember the title of it, but he had done a lot of commercials in New York. I didn't want to see any of his commercials. I met him up at the equipment rental house in New York, where we all used to rent cameras and stuff. And I liked him, and I told him my ideas for the film, and he said, great, I love that. And so I took him without ever really knowing his work. And then I did The Exorcist with him.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's several other cinematographers that I had a good relationship with, like John Alonzo, who I'd worked with in documentary, and then later Robbie Mueller. Caleb after the first film we did together was The Hunted a few years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I knew him socially, and he had great misgivings about working with me because I had had a lot of problems over the years with cinematographers, a great many disagreements, and I was known to have cut a number of them loose, and so Caleb was concerned about that, but I think, you know, his curiosity about working with me led him to do The Hunted. And then when it came to this, Killer Joe, I said, look, you're not going to want to do this because I'm going to do this for very little money. I'm going to make this, this is a very low-budget film. And he said, you know, I haven't shot that way in almost 50 years. And he said, maybe 30 years. But he said, I'd like to give it a shot. And so he went out and we got this Arriflex Alexa digital camera, which is, I think it's the first time it was used on a feature, or one of the first times. I think the results are quite beautiful. The 35-millimeter prints are the best I've ever seen. And we're very close personal friends, Caleb and I now, and his family and mine. And he's just a wonderful human being.
Mm.
The spirit that he brings to his all of his work, you know, comes from him and who he is. And he's a really wonderful, decent guy. One of the most straightforward people I've met, you know, out here in California in the industry. He threw himself in. We never made more than one or two takes in Killer Joe.
Do you find that the digital format, does it allow you a greater versatility at all?
To some extent, yes. I'll tell you where it really shines is in post-production. The prints that you're able to make from it, the latitude that you have to achieve greater contrast, deeper, richer blacks, more vivid colors if you want them, or desaturated colors, whatever you choose, the latitude you have is far, far greater than we ever had with 35mm, because 35mm was subject to the vicissitudes of the printing process.
Mm-hmm.
By that I mean, you know, the developers are... The printing process always had serious flaws. The printers that are located in the valley, the water in the valley or anywhere else, the water that goes into the developer is changing constantly. You know, the little... amoeba that are in the water are constantly changing, and the electricity that goes to the printer is constantly fluctuating. Now, sometimes to a greater or lesser degree, but we could never produce perfect prints. There would always be one reel that would come off bluish, another greenish. From shot to shot, you would get inconsistency because of the process, the changing nature of the water and the electricity. But none of that exists now with digital color timing. I mean, it took me, I think The Exorcist, for example, I think we threw away 20 reels for every reel that I approved because it was a highly imperfect process. You had far more latitude developing a still photograph than a whole reel or 12 reels or more of a film. And all that's gone now with digital. The results you get are similar to what you get when you're looking through the viewfinder of the camera.
Mm-hmm.
You're seeing it a pure image in focus. And so... yes, I think you have more latitude, but especially in post-production. The process is still very new, but I'm very pleased with it. You know, 35mm is now in the position of the 33 1/3 LP.
Mm-hmm.
You know, look, when they started recording music, you had all this needle scratch. You know, all this crap. You had, like, some of the great voices that they recorded, like Enrico Caruso, but it was the voice was always preceded and often drowned out by needle scratch, you know? And if you could hear Caruso without any of the technical imperfections, why wouldn't you want to do that? You know, why would you still want to hear an original recording of Caruso covered with surface noise? And that's how I feel about the digital print versus the 35 millimeter. I think the digital is an evolution.
Well, there is digital, and there's a increasing reliance on 3D. I mean, someone even like Scorsese says that he wants to shoot 3D from now on.
God bless him. I detest 3D, and I see no reason for it. To me, film and painting, any of the visual arts, is the illusion of depth in a two-dimensional image. I mean, I don't need 3D to look at a Rembrandt or a Da Vinci or a Michelangelo painting or a Vermeer or anybody else. I don't need 3D to look at a Picasso or a Braque Cubist painting.
Mm-hmm.
The illusion of depth is there, and that's part of the art of the visual arts. So I actually detest 3D.
Mm.
And it frankly hurts my eyes. And I think, you know, maybe someday someone will come along and be able to tell a useful story with it, but I haven't seen it yet. It's just a gimmick to me. I like IMAX because of the clarity of the image, but not 3D. What drew me to become a filmmaker was not anything to do with the technical abilities of the equipment.
Yeah.
What drew me was my interest in story and character. You know, that's what did and still does draw me. And the ability of film to produce emotions in people, whether it be to make them laugh or cry or be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I go to film for an emotional response. And there, you know, there are a lot of different kinds of film from which I've received that. A film like Alien scared the hell out of me.
Mm-hmm.
And Psycho, you know, and a number of other films. And then a simple film like Love Story. I thought, I don't know if you ever saw that.
Yes.
No, I'm sorry, not Love Story. I A Man and a Woman was the love story I've ever seen. I think it was made for $100,000 or less with two people and a beautiful score, and I found it very moving. And it was made for no money, and there was no technical expertise all over it. Just a lovely, simple love story called A Man and a Woman. And there are many films that have produced this emotional response in me, and that's all I look for in a film. True with any work of art, a piece of music or a painting or a play. Look, you've got to be virtually a Nazi or an ex-Nazi not to cry during Death of a Salesman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that will always produce an emotional response in people.
I agree with you. I mean, it all comes down to, no matter what the technology is, it always comes down to the most ancient of arts, and that's storytelling.
Exactly.
Now,
you know, Death of a Salesman was written, I guess, in the late 40s, 1940s. I haven't seen anything that has moved me more. And there was, when they made the film of it, there was no 3D in the film, no 48 frames per second.
Mm-hmm.
No technical innovation whatsoever. Just well-drawn characters in a story that so many people could identify with, and I believe still can and do.
Yeah.
And that's what I want out of cinema, and which I get very little of. I'm not interested in the latest technical innovation. I admire them tremendously, but I won't see a 3D film just because it's in 3D.
Mm-hmm.
Many others will. It's just not for me.
Let me tell you that, I mean, you've given me so much time today. I just want to leave you with this and tell you that you've made such a mark on my life, and your films mean a great deal to me. So this has been a great pleasure to speak with you.
Well, your questions are great, Jamie, and I enjoyed doing it very much. And, you know, stay in touch.
That's it for this episode of the Best of Movie Geeks United. You can access our entire archive of over 700 filmmaker interviews by visiting moviegeeksunited.net.